Good morning, everybody. I'm Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff with the ISO. We're excited to have you here today to talk through continue the discussion around making incremental improvements to the operating reserve market in Alberta. And I'm going to just provide some introductory remarks to get us going here. If we could hit to the next slide. As for those of you that have participated in ISO's engagements, these next few slides are going to be just a reminder, a refresher. The ISO does record these engagements and post them on our webpage, and through that, we do collect some personal information. So if you have concerns with how your personal information is being collected and treated, please reach out in regards to the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act. The information is on this slide here of who to get in touch with. For the next slide, the next couple of slides give some instructions around using Zoom. This is all, I think, old standard stuff for people. Coming up here, we're going to be figuring out how do we deal with hybrid type engagement meetings where we've got a mix of in-person and Zoom or virtual attendance. So we'll get some new slides to keep us on our toes here. But I think we all are well aware with two options to raise your questions. You can raise your hand and we'll unmute you, or you can type in your questions into the Q&A. Both work, but we are hoping to have some good discussion through in the agenda and our discussion and Q&A portions. And there's details here of how to do that on your 2-in-1 versus your smartphone. And more details here. If we could go to the next slide. I'm going to just kick us off with a few introductory remarks before I turn it over to Brendan. What do we have planned for this morning? After I finish my introductory remarks, Brendan's going to take us through most of the content today, starting with an overview of what we've heard from session one and the materials that we shared there and how we've incorporated or taken that feedback forward. And then we've got really two big discussion buckets, the group one design recommendations, which we showed a bit more details on for related to alternatives at session one. What we'll be reporting back today is the draft recommendations that we're taking forward, and we're looking for your questions on those as well as your input. We do have the agenda set up where we're going to talk through the group of design recommendations and then pause for discussion and Q&A. So please hold your clarifying questions, your comments and discussion items for that discussion and Q&A portion of the agenda, where we'll talk through all of those group one recommendations. Then switching over to group two, which is the second set of design alternatives that we were talking more at a high level at the last session. We continue to be, high level today in the sense of we're providing a more focused list of alternatives that we're considering. And again, we'll look to discuss those as a group and then close off with next steps. Hoping to use the morning as effectively as possible and your time as effectively as possible, sharing information with you directly and then gathering feedback and answering your questions throughout those two discussion and Q&A portions of the agenda. So before, who will you hear from today? You've already hearing from me. As I said, I'm Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff at the ISO. You can see on the screen here, Rupa Louisson, Manager of Markets, is here. And then Brendan Jewett, an economist in the markets team, is going to be sharing the majority of the content with you today. We also have a few support folks or other folks from the ISO on the call. We've got two people from Grid and Reliability, Biju Gopi and Leon Weinstein, who will support us with certain Q&A where it makes sense. And then the legal and regulatory affairs team supporting us through this rule process and running the engagement. Melissa Mitchell isn't here today. It's Carla Anderson's filling in, and Carla will be guiding the Q&A discussion for many of you. I think Carla will be a familiar face. With that, switch it over to a reminder of what this initiative is and why the ISO continues to see it as important to progress forward. Why are we here? We're looking to assess opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR market. overall to just improve its efficiency. We think the market is functioning, but we do remain of the view that there's opportunities to increase competitiveness of it and price fidelity within it, and that we should be exploring those now. Why do we think it's important? We think we need to be, we have highlighted that there is a increased or a high level of concentration in the OR markets, and that does put pressures on the ability for competitiveness it limits the competitive pressures, and we're looking for ways that we can reduce some of the barriers to increase competition in the market and streamline some of the components in the pricing frameworks that will allow us to increase price fidelity. If we could switch to the next slide, we heard this at the first session and we heard it in the feedback that there's really mixed views on the timing for this initiative. There's some that think now is the time to be looking at this, but then another set of stakeholders that we're really questioning how does this fit in the other initiatives that are underway across the ISO's activities, and maybe more broadly, how does this initiative fit in the priorities of everything that the industry has going on. And so I very much understand how much is underway within the industry right now and all the various priorities that agencies, government, and industry players are feeling as we look at a whole range of policy questions as well as initiatives and activities that are underway at the ISO as we move forward certain design changes, while having some recent reliability questions coming up as we see changes on the grid. And we don't think that the approach is that we stop this work or pause this work. What we're really taking more is an approach of, well, how do we make sure that we focus the changes to the OR review to be as narrow and agile as possible? Where are the incremental, focusing in on finding the incremental changes that we can implement in a fairly short timeline that we think will also have a positive impact on increasing competition, on improving price fidelity. And so our lens, as we look at all the various design options and alternatives, is very much focused in on that. And you'll see today that there are a couple alternatives that we have included in the list of options at session one that we're already identifying is, no, we don't think we should move this forward any further because the scope of work to implement it, or the interconnection with other rules and the complexity of doing so, doesn't warrant going forward with it right now, given that the objective is focused on incremental changes to create efficiencies. So in that, I think as a bit of a closing, it's really the summary is, we think the market is functioning, but concentration in the OR market limits the competitive pressures. There are some incremental changes that we think can be made to reduce barriers of entry, increase price fidelity, and that they are implementable in a time frame that we think matches the size that we want this initiative to be, knowing that there's so many other activities and changes coming as we go forward. We've also spent a lot of time ensuring that we're aligned internally, that and validated that it does make sense that there's a set of OR products that we procure now. The market design, or the market that we use to procure them, improving it will make sense for the long term, knowing that there could be changes to AS products in the long run, but the fundamental OR products that we're procuring now aren't changing anytime soon. And we also recognize how important your time is as you try to balance across all these various initiatives. So we're looking to, as I said, keep the engagement focused, keep the options and alternatives that we're looking at focused, and giving you information early around our thinking and gathering your feedback as effectively as possible as we go. So that is really the kind of the stage I hope to set for today and as we go forward for the rest of this initiative. If we switch to the next slide, it talks about really where we are in the stages. So presenting some draft recommendations to you today around the option, the group one design alternatives and sharing our early thinking for group two. We look to gather your feedback today and in a written comment form after the session today to help us influence those next levels of decisions, which really gets to how we want to move forward with developing the reserve, operating reserve price caps, as well as how to move forward with the group two design elements, which we would report back to you on in August and gather additional feedback before we shift over to the rule and implementation stages. We are, as you've heard, we're focused on really finding incremental changes that can be implemented in that year to 2 year time frame. So that's really guiding our scope here, and that's captured in the outline or the schedule listed here. If we could switch to the next slide. I think the objectives, hopefully made the objectives of the session clear as I've gone through, and just want to close off with a reminder in the next slide that stakeholder engagement is very important to us at the ISO, and especially in market and tariff design as we move forward important structural pieces for the industry that you operate in. And so we're very much appreciative of you being here today and providing your input from session one, as well as we go forward today. So with that, I turn it over to Brendan.
Thanks, Nicole. And I think we can just go straight on to the next slide, on slide 15. So in this section, we want to just briefly share some of our thoughts on some of the stakeholder feedback that we received, and in particular, stakeholder feedback that was not specific to a particular market design change, feedback that was more broad to the initiative as a whole. And we really appreciated the feedback that we received from participants from session one. It was very helpful for us, and we hope to continue that effective feedback going forward. We do want to highlight that in this section and throughout the presentation today, we're going to be bringing up just a selection of the feedback where we think it's valuable to share our thoughts or to discuss further, but we have reviewed all the feedback that we received. And so if a particular point of feedback isn't included for discussion in today's session, do have confidence that we did still consider that feedback when we were making our recommendations and informing the alternatives that we want to pursue further. We also just want to note that in this section, as well as the subsequent sections, we'll be focusing on feedback that was more critical in nature, just simply because supportive feedback, it is helpful for us to know we're on the right track with some things, but it's not going to prompt us to reconsider any of the rationale we've already shared. So it's really the critical feedback that we want to discuss further. Next slide, please. So the first general point of feedback, there were some stakeholders that made comments regarding the division of potential market design changes between group one and group two. And so the reason that we established these groups at first was really just to reflect the relative complexity of the options, and in order to make sure that we could divide the content appropriately between the first two sessions. And so the groups weren't necessarily meant to reflect the priority or the importance of any of the particular market design changes. And so we just want to clarify that since we're in session two now, that in this session and going forward in the engagement, we're happy to discuss any of the market design elements and the alternatives that we've brought forward. The next general point of feedback we received was relating to directives for contingency reserves. So we did notice that some stakeholders, they expressed concerns regarding the fairness of directives that are issued for providers of contingency reserves. We want to just remind stakeholders that directives are issued by system controllers to maintain reliability, and that those system controllers have the discretion to take the action that they require relating to directives to prevent adverse outcomes on the system. However, with that in mind, we do think it's critically important that as we're enabling new participation from types and sizes of assets that we may not have seen in the past. We need to make sure that system controllers have the tools they need in order to effectively utilize those services from all of the resources and all the participants that have contracted for them. And so in light of that and some of the feedback we received, we have initiated some interface updates, and these will assist the system controllers with issuing directives to the contracted providers of each service. So we expect that these updates will give the system controllers better visibility and better control throughout the entire range of providers for each operating reserve service to make sure that they have the all the tools available to them when they're issuing a directive. And we're currently exploring those updates internally, but we believe that they could be implemented as soon as sort of late Q2 this year. And we'll continue to monitor directives and directive rates and directive practices outside of this initiative as we go forward. The next point of feedback we received, there were a couple stakeholders that requested data on the performance of operating reserve providers based on the technology type of their asset. We want to ensure that everyone's aware that the ISO and MSA, we do continually monitor all OR providers to ensure that they are in compliance with the relevant rules and that they are meeting the technical standards that are applicable to them. And this enforcement will continue to ensure reliability and a level competitive playing field, especially as new types and new sizes of assets are entering the market. However, the data that's associated with this ongoing enforcement is confidential, and so we don't make that data public. However, if providers or participants are interested in knowing more about compliance activities, the MSA does include compliance updates in much of their ongoing reporting. Another general point of feedback we had, there were stakeholders that wanted to see more quantification of the potential benefits for some of the design changes that we have brought forward. We agree that where it's possible and practical to do so, quantifying benefits in order to have a clear cost-benefit analysis can be beneficial. However, the nature of many of the changes that we are bringing forward in this initiative, such as changes that enable entry, they make that type of analysis highly speculative. And so while it may be technically feasible to perform some of that analysis, quantifying, for example, the megawatts of capacity that might enter the market after we've made a particular change is likely too speculative in our view in order to be meaningful for the purpose of cost-benefit analysis. However, we will continue to perform quantitative analysis where we think it is necessary and feasible in order to support our recommendations. And we also want to stress that especially where the implementation cost and complexity are relatively minor, as is the case with many of the alternatives that we're pursuing in this initiative, we are of the view that economic theory and fair, efficient, and open competition principles can be relied upon in order to justify the change, especially in light of the ISO's statutory obligation to enable open competition. And we also received a request from some participants relating to the concentration metrics that we shared in session one. Those metrics that we shared in session one were calculated as part of the 2019 market power mitigation advice that we provided to the Minister of Energy. And those metrics included the actuals for 2019 as well as a forecast for 2021. And so we have updated those metrics for 2022. The two metrics that we shared earlier were both referred to as concentration ratios, which indicate the highest or the sum of market share of the highest X participants. So in this case, the highest five participants for the CR5 and the largest four participants for the CR4. We also received feedback that some participants wanted to see the market share of the single largest provider, or what you might think of as a CR1. And so we've included that as well for the three reserve products here. And so in doing this, the 2022 actuals generally came in approximately 5 to 10% lower than what the 2021 forecast was that we made in 2019. And so while the market is still concentrated based on the 2022 actual metrics that we're seeing here, the new entry that we have seen into the market over this time period is one of the contributing factors to the conclusion that we've shared in session one, as well as the introduction today, that the market is functioning in a high level and that broader structural market design changes are not needed at this time. So with that, we'd like to move into the group one market design elements for which we shared potential alternatives in session one. Moving to the next slide, please.
Brendan, we're just gonna, hi, it's Carla. We're just gonna pause. We've got a question from Akira, just before you move on to the next session.
Okay.
Oh, he has taken his hand down. Oh, no, there we go.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
This is Kira Yamamoto from Transalta. You did mention that you're putting an interface, and you talked a lot about how you've listened to feedback. I think we had raised concerns about some of the your considerations of going towards a 1 megawatt threshold. We had asked for data about those directive levels because we had suspected that there was a difference, significant difference, between large and small providers. You didn't provide any of that information, but continue to make the recommendation. And then in the most recent MSA report, it substantiated the, our view that there is a big difference between the amount that you're actually directing large providers and small providers. I think we've mentioned it and raised it several times that your claim to be looking for competition or seeking competitive or competition or enhanced competition is ignoring the fact that you're actually creating two different types of products. And I think these are substantial issues that we've asked you to look at several different times, and rather than blindly going down a path of suggesting certain recommendations. And I think, frankly, at this point in time, after two sessions in the distributed energy resources, as well as with your most recent operating reserves, operating market reserves session, we're not feeling very confident that you're listening to stakeholders or meaningfully consulting on this in terms of providing data about the actual performance of these operating reserves products and hearing the claims or hearing the concerns that we're raising. In fact, you're not even being very upfront about providing data on this stuff. So I'm just raising this as a substantial concern for us, that it feels like while you've got a lot to talk about how good your engagement approach is, we're not actually seeing it in practice.
Thank you, Akira. That's noted. I think I would just respond by saying that we did take that feedback into consideration. And so that is what has motivated the changes that we're exploring to directive rates. We're aware of the data that the MSA has made public, and we didn't see value in duplicating that data on the public record, as the MSA has already shared that and commented on it publicly. And so we've taken that data, and we believe that the interface updates that we're pursuing as part of this initiative have the potential to resolve some of the discrepancy that was highlighted in the MSA report.
But that discrepancy didn't just emerge. And what I'm saying is, it sounds like you didn't respond to the data when we actually explained that this was a potential issue. In fact, now you're just kind of claiming that you're now working towards a solution, but you never even acknowledged that this was a potential legitimate concern, or even showed the data when you requested a year beforehand, before the MSA released them. I have to say that that is a substantial gap in terms of stakeholder consultation and trustworthiness on your side. Like, I do believe that there are some significant technical deficiencies And just claiming that you've got an interface that's going to fix that problem is not very comforting.
Okay, well, we appreciate that feedback. Thanks, Sakura. Are there any other questions we need to resolve now, or Carla? Not hearing any, I think I can go forward with the group one design recommendation section.
Sorry, Brendan, we were just allowing Horst. I had myself on mute, my apologies. Just asking Horst, please go ahead, Horst.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I just wanted to kind of add to Akira's comment that I find that kind of the way this consultation is progressing seems kind of a bit out of sync with where the concerns from the industries actually are. We started with this initiative because the ISO had some great ideas because they wanted to change the OR market. Participants came with their actual concerns as participants participating in the market. And it does really look like the ISO didn't do anything with the concerns. It took an MSA report pointing out that there is an issue for something to happen. And even then, what happened was not kind of out in the open and saying that, okay, yes, we agree with the MSA, there is an issue, and kind of let's clean this up, and this is how this would be addressed and why it would work. And instead, we're getting another consultation session that, from the agenda, looks very much like session one, in that the ISO is kind of, at least from the presentation, it looked to me that we're just moving along as if, yeah, as if stakeholders didn't participate. So it seems very much out of sync with what industry wants and what industry is interested in compared to what the ISO might feel is necessary. Thank you.
Thanks, Horst. I think we acknowledge that in combination with Akira's comments as well. And so I think we can help describe today how some of the feedback that we received in session one has been incorporated. And if there are points of feedback that you feel that we haven't taken into account sufficiently, then we do invite you to stress that, and we will be sure to take that into consideration going forward.
Perfect. So, Brendan, we have one question in the Q&A. We've got, are the market concentration metrics calculated using offered volumes or cleared volumes?
Thank you for asking that. I should have clarified. It's neither. They are calculated based on qualified volumes, which mirrors what was done in the market power mitigation advice. And the reason for that is we feel that just looking at volumes within the market, because it is a voluntary market, there's not a must-offer requirement. We feel that just looking at volumes in the market would tend to understate the competitive pressure in the market. And so by using qualified volumes, it gives a better indication of the total amount of capability that is able to compete in that market.
Perfect. Thanks, Brendan. We have no more questions.
All right, so I think we can move to the next slide. So in this section, we will briefly do a recap and then share some of the updated considerations and the draft recommendation for the Group 1 design elements that we started exploring in Session 1. And so those include the equilibrium pricing and the ISO bid price, standing offers, offer transparency, and the minimum qualification and offer size. As I mentioned earlier, we will share some points of critical stakeholder feedback that we've received and any updated considerations relating to those. And we do thank participants for their feedback. And similarly, if there's a point that is not raised in today's presentation, we did consider it. But in light of some of the feedback we just received, we do invite stakeholders to clarify and expand in their written feedback to us if they feel that a particular point of feedback was not considered thoroughly, and we'll take that into account going forward. Next slide. So these are the economic principles and the objectives that put them into context in evaluating the operating reserve market design. So I shared these in session one, so I don't think I'll go through them in detail, but just a reminder that economic principles used by the ISO, they are competition, effective operations and pricing, cost, and public interest. And so we've included a brief assessment against these principles for each of the recommendations and design alternatives today. So the first group one design element relates to equilibrium pricing and the ISO bid price. And so the current practice is that the equilibrium price in the active OR markets is determined by taking the average of the marginal clearing offer and the ISO bid price. The ISO bid prices are not visible to parties that are outside of the WADEX trading platform. And the ISO bid price currently acts effectively as both an offer and price cap. And dispatched active reserve providers who clear the market are then paid the energy pool price plus this equilibrium price, which can be and is often negative. The ISO proposed alternative that we shared in session one is to remove equilibrium pricing and instead to set the uniform market price at the marginal offer price. The index to the energy pool price for active reserves today would remain. And then the ISO bid price, in effect, would be replaced with a price cap. And this price cap could be disclosed in a more public fashion. And so the primary piece of stakeholder feedback we received on this related to the level of the price cap. Most stakeholders felt that the change would either have a neutral or positive impact. However, the level of the price cap was the primary factor that participants were interested in learning more about. And so once we have the intent of the design and the draft recommendation explored with stakeholders, that's when we will start looking at the level of the price cap. And we believe that we can do that in session three. And so just to share some of the very initial thinking on where the price cap will be set, many of the principles for setting the price caps for the OR products will mirror those that we've used in the past for setting the energy price cap. However, they'll also need to take into consideration that the energy pool price is passed through. And so that provides many of the price signals and recovery opportunities that the energy pool price does. And so those principles include allowing for the reasonable opportunity for cost recovery, with the definition of costs, including both fixed costs and commitment costs in Alberta's market framework. We also need to allow for price signals in the OR market to indicate scarcity of operating reserves. And then, of course, the other objective of the price cap, like all price caps, is to limit the potential for there to be the abuse of market power. And the evaluation against these principles will be informed by the practices in other jurisdictions, although many of these jurisdictions have fundamentally different market structures that we'll need to take into account. We'll also be analyzing historical market outcomes to assess the appropriate price cap level, while keeping in mind that we may need to make adjustments for updated cost fundamentals. And we will be undertaking relevant and feasible quantitative analysis where it can support some of our potential alternatives. So looking at the economic principles against competition, we believe that removing equilibrium pricing will set the price based solely on competitive forces, and that by simplifying the pricing in the market, that may encourage competition, both through new entry and potentially more robust competition of existing market participants. Relating to effective operations and pricing, we believe that this simplifies the offer strategy for participants. It will enhance price fidelity as the price can better reflect the competitive environment at the time. And We want to ensure that the ISO bid price allows for the reasonable opportunity for cost recovery while accounting for product scarcity and limiting the potential for abuse of market power. Relating to cost, the implementation cost for this will be explored further and in more detail once the design recommendations have been determined, but we have conducted initial assessments internally, and we expect the cost to be very minimal. This will be a common consideration that you'll see throughout several of the design elements that we'll look at today. And relating to public interest, we think that if we can share the ISO bid price or the ISO OR price cap, should we get rid of equilibrium pricing, if we can share that more publicly, that will increase transparency. So the draft recommendation is to pursue the ISO's proposed alternative of removing equilibrium pricing and to set the uniform clearing price at the marginal offer price, and then to replace the ISO bid price with a publicly disclosed price cap. And in session three, we will analyze the level of the price cap further and share more information at that time. The next design element that we looked at in session one was standing offers. And so the current practice, we do not have standing offers in the OR market, which means that market participants must submit new offers to the WADEX platform each time they wish to participate. The ISO's proposed alternative was to allow for market participants to submit standing offers, and then these offers would carry forward and be automatically included in future trading intervals. And our initial proposal was that these offers would remain until they were either changed by the participant or if the trader that submitted them was deactivated. The stakeholder feedback we received on this was primarily leading to risks relating to reliability implications. And so there were concerns that if participants were to submit standing offers and those standing offers remained in the market for a long time, that they may no longer be reflective of the actual capability, and that if those offers were to clear the market, that could run the risk of reliability impacts if those volumes were to be cleared in the market. And so some participants suggested that an expiry date could be added to the standing offers as a mitigation measure. And the ISO agrees that this would likely be an effective mitigation of this issue. However, there was also just generally little interest in this change across the board from many different types of market participants. And so our updated considerations, we explored this possibility as an opportunity to streamline participation and to perhaps reduce the burden on participants who participate in the OR market on a regular basis. However, we do not believe that this change is required for market integrity in order to enhance competition or price fidelity. And so assessing against our economic principles relating to competition, we thought that this may reduce the burden of participation. Relating to effective operations, stakeholders brought up that an expiry date or another mitigation measure would be necessary in order to ensure that offers are still reflective of availability. And relating to cost, similarly, the implementation cost would be explored further once we landed a design recommendation. However, the initial internal assessment was expected to be minimal. And so our draft recommendation, in light of the stakeholder feedback that we received, is to not pursue standing offers at this time. We believe that there is limited interest among participants and that the potential for reliability impacts outweighs the benefit at this time. However, as with all the recommendations we're making, we may adjust it based on further stakeholder feedback that we receive, especially as we progress Group 2 changes, if participants feel that any of the Group 2 market design alternatives perhaps create the justification for standing offers, we would be interested in hearing that feedback. So the next group one market design element relates to offer transparency. And there are two parts to this. The first is relating to the format of the procurement itself. Currently, offers to the WADEX platform are visible to all participants as soon as they have been submitted. And I think I'll refer to this going forward as just being a simple open auction format. And participants often will submit offers in the very final moments of each procurement in response to this auction format. And then after the auction has concluded, 60-day lagged offer information is available. However, this information includes the clearing price and not the offer price, and the participant attribution, and the only offer information is shared is that which cleared the market, or in other words, uncleared offers are not shared in any timeline. And so the ISO proposed alternative is to move the auction to a sealed bid format and to align the offer disclosure for the operating reserve markets with the offer disclosure that we currently undertake for the energy market, which is stipulated by the FEOC regulation. And so this would have us publish the offer price, the volume, and the offer control party of all OR volumes with a 60-day lag. And these changes would align the OR market with the energy market in that the real-time transparency would be reduced while ex post transparency after the auction has concluded would be increased. So the stakeholder feedback we received, there were stakeholders that supported the current simple open auction format, and they had concerns with reduced information in the market if a sealed bid format is adopted. In particular, some participants highlighted competitive benefits or price discovery that are associated with the current level of information in the market. And participants also shared that especially if we're moving to a sealed bid format, that ex post data should be shared as quickly as possible. Similarly, often citing price discovery as a benefit of this information. And we also understood from some participants that they use the current open auction format as a means of managing offers that they do not wish to be partially accepted. Or in other words, they can ensure that their offer block is either completely within the market and will be accepted in its entirety or will not be accepted at all. So some of the updated considerations in analyzing the current simple open auction format when looking for comparisons, particularly in other electricity jurisdictions, there's simply limited experience with this format as it is not often employed. As it's known to be especially vulnerable to implicit coordination and to price manipulation. There are instances where open formats are used. However, these typically include what's referred to as a clock mechanism, which is a dynamic action on the part of the auctioneer by which they'll cycle through several different price levels and participants can submit and adjust their offers or bids accordingly. Just as a very high level summary of some of the auction types that we're aware of that are well studied and that considerations are widely known for. The two broad types of auctions include sealed bid auctions, such as the energy market we have today, as well as open auctions. Common variants of sealed bid auctions include the first price auction, which is what our energy market uses. Second price auctions, which are sometimes referred to as Vickrey auctions, are also well studied and considered in the literature as well as in practice. Open auction types, there are two main types. However, there are many, many different subvariants of these. One is the ascending clock, which in this context would be referred to as a Dutch auction, where the auctioneer would go through an ascending series of price levels. And then there's also a descending clock where the auctioneer would go through a descending series of price levels, which in this context would be referred to sometimes as an English auction. Generally, sealed bid auctions are preferred for repeated markets. This is because price discovery can occur over time through the procurements And so price discovery is not as critical in any single given procurement. And also in repeated markets, participants can learn from each other's behavior, which leads to a, especially in the face of high concentration, a higher risk of implicit coordination between participants. In open format auctions, these are especially preferred when an auction is only held once, as the price discovery must occur within the auction itself, and dynamic price discovery does not occur between multiple auctions. And also when costs are unknown, or the value of the product is particularly unknown, because in those cases, price discovery is especially important, and participants learning from their valuation of their rivals is particularly important in those instances. So looking at some of the considerations of both parts of this offer transparency alternative against our economic principles, relating to competition, the sealed bid format is generally less vulnerable to implicit coordination and price manipulation, and offer price information is currently not published. However, we could potentially aid in transparency if we do publish offer price information after an appropriate delay. Relating to effective operations and pricing, the sealed bid format may reduce the opportunity for price discovery. However, we also believe that price discovery opportunity is currently minimal in the market due to the dominant offer strategy, whereby participants offer at the last moment. And in that case, the auction effectively functions closer to a sealed bid procurement anyway. The daily operating reserve price report that we currently publish through ETS, this does show the price for each operating reserve product for each day. And we believe that this is an important factor in allowing for price discovery over time. This means that participants can know what the valuation was and what the clearing price was for each product in a very short delay from when the auction actually occurred. And relating to cost uncertainty, we believe that the primary source of cost uncertainty for providing operating reserves is the opportunity cost associated with the pool price, and that the pool price index for active reserves currently mitigates that risk. Relating to cost, similarly, again, we've conducted an initial internal assessment where we expect it to be minimal, but we can conduct a more thorough assessment once our draft recommendation has been landed. And relating to public interest, we believe that increased transparency is generally in the public interest unless there are competitive or commercial issues associated with the information. And also that dynamic open auction formats, such as the ascending and descending clock formats discussed earlier, are generally more complex and create more involvement from the administrative side of the auction. So our draft recommendation is still to move to a sealed bid format at this time. We believe that it has the right mix of incentives and mitigates the appropriate risks. To be analyzed further, we want to look more at the timing of offer information disclosure. So as I mentioned, parties did stress that if we're to move to a sealed bid format, that detailed offer information should be released immediately after the fact. I also mentioned that price discovery was commonly cited as a reason for why offer information should be disclosed promptly. We're going to be seeking feedback from participants, both for discussion today as well as in the stakeholder matrix, on if and why the daily price report that's published is not sufficient for price discovery purposes, as it does publish publicly the price for each product every day. And we're also interested in impact and accommodations for the inflexible offer blocks that I mentioned earlier. If we were to move to a sealed bid format, could we enable more competition by potentially allowing for offer blocks for which participants can elect for them to be not partially filled in the day ahead OR market, so that their block will either be accepted in its entirety or not at all? The final Group 1 design element is related to minimum qualification and offer size. The current practice is that the minimum qualification size for regulating reserves is 15 megawatts, for spinning reserves is 10 megawatts, and for supplemental reserves is 5 megawatts. And the minimum offer size for all OR products is 5 megawatts. The dispatch tolerance is currently 1 megawatt for assets that are less than or equal to 20 megawatts in size, and 5% for assets that are greater than 20 megawatts in size. And the ISO's proposed alternative is to reduce minimum qualification and offer size to 1 megawatt for all products, and to change dispatch tolerance to 5% for all assets. Some of the stakeholder feedback we received, there were concerns about the technical feasibility of this change, including the ability for the ISO to monitor compliance of these smaller assets. There was also interest from some participants in moving to a size below 1 megawatt, for example, 100 kilowatts, to align with some FERC jurisdictions, and also concerns about directive practices relating to small assets, which we have discussed some of our thinking about earlier. Updated considerations. Firstly, there has been a recent technical study that we conducted, and this technical study did confirm that it is technically feasible to lower the minimum size threshold to 1 megawatt for all OR products without any reliability impact. And this conclusion was shared, as well as many other considerations about smaller assets as part of the Distributed Energy Resources, or DERS, markets participation engagement that was conducted in 2021. ISO systems do not currently have the capability to dispatch offers below 1 megawatt. And when we've explored this opportunity internally, for us to introduce this capability would involve significant costs and a relatively longer time frame. As well, moving to 5% dispatch tolerance for all assets would ensure a level playing field so that small assets are held to the same standard as larger assets, and also reduces red tape as the requirement can be streamlined for all providers. We also want to emphasize that SCADA data will be required for these small assets in order to ensure that we can still effectively monitor their compliance. So relating to our economic principle of competition, we believe that more participation from different resource types and configurations can be enabled, and that a 5% dispatch tolerance will ensure a level playing field. Relating to effective operations and pricing, our internal technical studies have confirmed the capability for assets that are at least 1 megawatt without any negative reliability impacts. And the ISO systems do not currently have the ability to handle offers or dispatches below 1 megawatt in size. SCADA and maximum authorized real power data will still be required for these small assets, as it's necessary to ensure effective compliance monitoring. And the 5% dispatch tolerance for all assets ensures that reserve volumes are still reliable and consistent, even down to the 1 megawatt level. Relating to cost, we expect that increased competition may lead to overall cost savings in the market, and that the cost, if we were to explore moving below 1 megawatt, would be very significant. The cost associated with moving down to 1 megawatt, the initial internal assessment, again, is expected to be minimal, but we can conduct a more thorough assessment of that once the design recommendation has been determined. And relating to public interest, by ensuring uniform rule treatment throughout the different asset sizes, this will streamline participation and reduce red tape. So our draft recommendation is to reduce the minimum qualification and offer size to 1 megawatt for all products, and to change the dispatch tolerance to 5% for all assets. So with that, we're happy to take some questions and discuss some of the ISO's rationale and draft recommendations for the Group 1 design elements.
Thanks, Brendan. We're going to go through the questions in line with the order options they were presented, and accidentally hit and answered on Santi's questions. So you'll find it in the answer tab in the Q&A. We're gonna do that one first. So Santi, and if we can ask stakeholders, please put your organization name in the Q&A. Unfortunately, we just see your first and last name, but not your organization. And so if you could add that, that would be appreciated. So Santi's question, does the AESO intend on implementing a single OR price cap applicable across all products or distinct ones for each?
I think we're open to stakeholders' feedback on that, and we can explore that in session three. However, I think there are fundamental reasons why you might think that the price cap may differ between the OR products. And so we'd want to make sure that we take that into account. So I think it is certainly on the table that the different products would have different price caps from each other.
Wonderful. Thanks, Brendan. We're next going to go to Akira at 9:47 a.m. The energy price cap does not reflect the scarcity of reserves. In fact, it is only because we have an inadequate mechanism which prices, I got Invisalign, my apologies, shortage events at 1 cent per megawatt higher than the energy price cap that the AESO could even suggest this. A more apt approach is to implement operating reserve demand curve, and then the energy price cap could be considered to signal scarcity of reserves. Will the AESO be moving to this type of cap and ORDC shortage pricing mechanism?
So an operating reserve demand curve would be out of the scope of this initiative. I also just want to clarify the statement I made earlier about scarcity and that the principles relating to the OR price caps, we think closely resemble those for the energy market. And so while the energy market price cap is calibrated in order to be able to send scarcity signals for the energy market, we think that the OR price cap should be calibrated in order to send scarcity signals for the OR market. So it was not my intention to suggest that the current energy price cap sends scarcity signals for the operating reserve market.
Perfect. Thanks, Brendan. Next question, we're going to go to Andrea at 9:39. If the AESO allows standing offers, how would the AESO prioritize multiple standing offers of the same price?
I believe we're not recommending to pursue standing offers. However, I think standing offers would go into the market at the same way that offers do today. And so if they all come in at the same time, I agree that that would potentially be a risk. And so we'd need to look at potentially ordering them by volume or something like that. However, our draft recommendation at this time is not to pursue standing offers.
Thanks. All right, we're going to Richard at 9:40. Since standing offers, and Richard's with IPCA, standing offers does not take much effort to implement, and with other changes in the market, such as OR price cap, changes in DOS, and reducing the OR market to 1 megawatt would increase competition. Why not go ahead with it?
I think the feedback we got from stakeholders was that they saw the risk as exceeding the benefit. And that includes stakeholders from a wide range of sides of the market, representing a wide range of participants, from small participants, large participants. And so I believe that if stakeholders do think that we should pursue that further, we've not removed the possibility of looking at standing offers. However, if the interest isn't there from participants, we believe that the impact likely won't be extremely large in magnitude. And so at this time, it's something that we can pass on in order to focus on implementing some of the higher impact changes as part of this initiative.
Perfect. Thanks. We are moving down to Parag, and my apologies if I've mispronounced your name. Not sure what company. The current auction, this is at 9:55 a.m., the current auction provides the information to the market participants about the liquidity in the market, ratio of market megawatts that got cleared as compared to megawatts that were priced out. With the new information disclosure that ISO is looking at, would be ideal if ISO not only look at providing pricing information, but also provide details of how liquid the market, more transparent information.
I think we would be interested in hearing more detailed feedback on that, about why participants feel that is useful to them as part of their offer strategy or as part of supporting robust competition in the market. And so along with some of the other information that we'll be asking relating to price discovery, for example, we invite stakeholder feedback to help us understand why things such as that are important and valuable to participants in the market.
Thanks, Brendan. That last question, Ann Andreas, they were both from Heartland Generation, and Santi was from Capital Power. All right. The next question is another from Santi at 9:48. And this is Capital Power. Under the sealed bid format, does the ISO intend on maintaining the current first-to-offer tiebreak for equal-priced offers?
I think hearing that, as well as the similar concern relating to standing offers that was raised earlier, I think that's a good question. And to be honest, I don't know that we've considered that. And so I think we will be sure to invite stakeholder feedback on what they think would be appropriate for that. For example, whether we should move to a practice more similar to what's used in the energy market today, or if something like the timing of the offer is still the more appropriate mechanism. I think we're open to stakeholder feedback on what they feel would be appropriate for that.
Right, thanks. And the next one's from Joseph, and I believe this is TransAlta. In the last section, you mentioned this is 9:49 a.m., in the last section, you mentioned that it was important for price signals to indicate the scarcity of reserves. And then in the next section, proposed to remove the only price signal the market provides. Ancillary offer prices drive supply. Visible market offers are the only signal that the market requires additional megawatts. Removing prices as a scarcity signal removes the incentive to offer when the market needs supply most. Is this not inconsistent with your stated objectives?
So I don't think we're removing price. We would still be and still would acknowledge that it's very important for us to release the price promptly after the market has concluded. And so in that sense, it would mirror the energy market and that participants, it's a sealed bid auction as participants are submitting their offers. And once the price is settled, it's disclosed publicly, and then participants can respond to that price signal by perhaps introducing more of their qualified volume into the market or something else to that effect. So we still want to ensure that we're sending timely and accurate price signals to the market while mitigating some of the other risks that we've mentioned earlier.
Perfect. Thanks, Brendan. We're just going to go to Joseph. He's got his hand up. Joseph, you'll just have to unmute yourself. Joseph, on your side, you'll have to click unmute. There you go. Oh, he's now gone. All right. Prag, we will allow you to talk. You have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Thanks. So as a follow-up to the question that I asked, what was the intent of understanding the liquidity? So it's pretty similar to the current supply curve. So obviously you have the demand curve and the supply curve. So understanding the supply curve helps market participants know whether there's how competitive the market is and whether there's a scarcity of the players in it. So it helps market players getting more information on that. And that's one of the reasons why even when we do trade right now, we look at the supply curve to understand how competitive it is and how the curve is going on. And that's one of the reasons why we were intending that providing pricing information is great, but having a little more information on the supply curve as well in terms of the providers, that would be great.
Sure, we will take that away. I think I'd also be interested in perhaps having you elaborate on that in your written feedback. I think our understanding of the economic literature of these associated auction formats is that in a sealed format, you'll be better incented to submit a more competitive offer strategy in a sealed format compared to in a open format. As you mentioned, in an open format, a participant may see that the market is not very competitive at a particular time and then respond by submitting a less competitive offer strategy. And so if there are other factors that factor into your offer behavior or reasons commercially that you need to see the supply curve in order to manage your offers, I think we're interested to better understand that.
And does that and is that answer your question?
Yes. So for now, we'll provide more details in terms of how that helps us. So yeah, thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we've got.
And sorry, Carla. Maybe just one more thing, just to reiterate, is we also understand that oftentimes the offers that are submitted into the current open auction format in advance, so that participants may see those offers and respond to them. We believe those offers often aren't reflective of what the actual clearing price or clearing volume will be in the market, because so much of the volume in the market does come in the very last moment. And so we don't believe that participants can effectively see those offers today and respond to them. And so we just think that's one more limiting factor to the usefulness of the visibility of offers in real time.
Thanks for that clarification, Brendan. We've got Horst has his hand up. Horst, just you have to unmute. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. It's Horst from Suncor. First of all, I think it would have been nice if we could have had comments and questions after each section. So I will limit myself to the pricing-related ones and maybe raise my hand afterwards on small units. Regarding pricing, I think a very important element we haven't talked about is that the AS market is different in that it is entirely voluntary. Unless, contrary to the must offer, must supply obligation, the AS market is a choice that has incremental requirements, but potentially offers incremental revenue opportunities. So I think we need to be very careful as we're looking at pricing and price caps to just import things from the energy market. For example, whether the price cap is too low or not, by the time we get close to the price cap, everybody must have offered in the energy market. In the OR market, if the price cap is out of sync with what participants are kind of expecting, the ISO will find themselves short of OR, which is a problem, a reliability problem. So I think we need to keep more track of what the differences are. With regard to the bidding and the visibility, I think we need to also be very clear that yes, you're right, because everybody kind of snipes at the end of the interval. It's basically a blind offer already, but the information is available immediately afterwards. And the ISO seems to be pretty kind of lax to kind of disconnect the two items. That is the most crucial piece, is that participants who are about to participate potentially in the next auction want to know what the market looks like. Because if the price clears at a low level and I don't realize that, you know what, actually the supply stack was pretty thin, I might decide to just call it a day and you might find yourself in trouble for the subsequent auction. So I think the real-time price discovery, it all hangs together. And so to just kind of be kind of lax and kind of disconnect the two and say, okay, we're going to go blind here and then maybe disclose 60 days later, I think that kind of completely misses the mark. And it's also information I think that participants have provided after session one already. So I'm a bit surprised that those concerns are not kind of more front and center here in this discussion. And yeah, I will raise my comment later on kind of small units. Thanks.
So Horst, your comment about the subsequent auction, is that referring to, say, going into the sup auction from the spin auction? So like a subsequent auction within the same procurement day, is that what you're referring to?
Right, because we're procuring from the same asset. I mean, that was actually one thing kind of on your very early slide where you didn't have kind of comments open. When I looked at market share of the top five, top four, does that include how they interact? Because, we may have a high concentration in the reg market, but after reg is sold, maybe the concentration in the spin market is already lower because the big players have already sold their volume, right? It's one set of volume that generators have available or other suppliers. And so there's interactions between the markets and we can't look at them in isolation.
So, I mean, there were a few things in there. Firstly, you're highlighting the risk and how there are differences, fundamental differences between energy and AS that need to be considered as you're, porting principles from the energy market to the AS market. I think that is definitely in our mind, and we're interested in more specific risks or ways in which we need to consider them differently. So certainly want to hear your feedback on that, especially like, as you mentioned, as we go into potentially exploring different levels for the price cap. And then in terms of the visibility in subsequent auctions within the same day, I think our intent right now is that participants would be able to see the clearing price of a product as they go into the subsequent auction. And so I apologize that perhaps I wasn't clear in the information we've shared so far, but that would be the intent. So if you're a spinning reserve provider and that auction is closed and you're going into the supplemental procurement, you would know what the clearing price was for spinning reserve at that time. And so we can share more details about that as we share our detailed recommendation in session three that will include all those sort of kind of implementation details. But hopefully that is at least somewhat mitigating to that concern, but definitely interested to hear more feedback on that. And then also back to the concentration metrics, just to highlight that the concentration metrics are based on qualified volumes. And so they're not based on any sort of participation in the market, whether it's offered or cleared volumes or anything like that. They're just the qualified volumes for each service.
Perfect.
Thanks. So, the chart isn't that important to me, but regarding the disclosure of price, I understood that you would disclose price. But the thing is, the price might actually tell me that, price is low, I'm not interested in the subsequent auctions. If I have volumes that were offered in the market and I can look at the stack, I can say that, but there's actually a pretty good opportunity that the other markets are clearing higher or better and I become interested. So price information on its own, I think, is less valuable than price and kind of offer information kind of to see how thick the supply curve is.
Okay, thank you, Horst. That sort of feedback is helpful for us.
Thanks,
Horst. All right, we're just going to go back to our Q&A, and we're going to start with Ethan at 9:53, and he's from TransAlta. Currently, there are resources which participate as an aggregate to provide reserves. Currently, there are resources in this aggregate which are under the 5 megawatt threshold, resources in this aggregate which are under the 5 megawatt threshold.
So Ethan, thanks for your question. So whether you're an aggregate or an individual asset, you need to meet the minimum qualification, size qualification requirements as is currently written. So to answer your question, there are no aggregates which are under the 5 megawatt threshold or the respectable thresholds, be it regulating spin or sub in the market as currently is. And once you meet that qualification threshold, the size qualification threshold, then obviously you need to be able to meet all of the technical requirements in order to be qualified to participate in the OR market.
Wonderful. Thanks, Piju. Next question from Akira at 9:54, also from TransAlta. If you can't dispatch assets less than 1 megawatt, how are you able to monitor and manage dispatch tolerances that will be in the kilowatt range, example, 5% of a 1 megawatt asset, requires the ISO to monitor compliance at the 50 kilowatt level? No, not, yeah.
So here, to answer this question, I'm not really familiar with the nuance of dispatch tolerance, and maybe somebody on the team can help. But at the whole point, and I think we've stressed this in the beginning, is meeting the technical requirements is one aspect. As we move to the minimum qualification size requirements as proposed instead of the current size requirements, SCADA is an important piece of it. That is a mandatory requirement. We need to monitor performance of any asset providing operating reserves on the market. So that is a critical piece of requirement that we would have. So minimum size qualification requirements, the proposal, that's only one part of the equation. But we definitely want to make sure that SCADA is there, that they're able to be dispatched and meet all dispatch and communication requirements as currently exists with the technical requirements of the standard.
Perfect. Thanks,
Biju. Yeah, thanks, Biju. I think just to very briefly add on to that, just to be clear, I think the ISO systems that handle offers and dispatches are not the same or do not use the same data, the SCADA data that we would use for compliance monitoring. And so while those systems can handle increments of 1 megawatt, the SCADA data that is used for ex post monitoring can handle granularity at a level much below 1 megawatt.
Thanks, Brendan. Another question from Akira TransAlta. Why is the reasonable to evaluate the cost of a proposal after you have made the recommendation? Isn't the cost consideration critical to the evaluation of whether a recommendation should even be made?
I think that's a good point, and there's a balance to strike there. It takes time and effort to thoroughly assess the implementation considerations of our particular change related to rules and our IT systems and a variety of other potential changes. And so what we've found to be effective is to do an initial assessment where we can get a high level sense of what the cost may be for different alternatives. And then at that point, we can know if a particular alternative is, say, just far too costly to warrant further consideration. And then at the point that we know which design alternatives are most promising or are potentially worth exploring in more detail, that then allows us to be much more prudent with the work that we undertake to do comprehensive implementation cost studies, IT studies, technical studies, those sorts of things, in order to make sure we're only doing those studies on a narrow set of alternatives that we think are valuable to explore further. And so there is, to be sure, a balance to strike there. But we feel that the initial assessment that we've done has identified the various design changes in this initiative, in large part due to the small implementation cost that we anticipated based on that initial assessment.
Perfect. Thanks, Brendan. And then we're going to James, also from TransAlta, and this is a follow-up to Akira's question on directives earlier in the session. And so to address the MSA's concerns and align with your recommendation, please provide clarity regarding why the ISO has historically dispatched larger assets instead of equally weighting dispatches across all the assets that have sold the ancillary product, i.e. dispatching smaller units. What measures will be put in place to address going forward? On that note, doesn't lowering the volume threshold further exacerbate an issue already identified by the MSA?
So the current practice for issuing directives is that system controllers have the discretion in order to take whatever action they believe is required in order to maintain reliability at any given time. That practice will not be changing, and so that will continue going forward. The interface updates that we have just started initially exploring, what they will do is make sure that it is very easy for system controllers to access and utilize all the resources that are available to them, to ensure that we're making use of all the resources that have contracted to provide a particular product or service. And we believe that going forward will help make sure that the bias or the differential in the directives received by any particular asset or class of asset is reduced.
Right. Thanks, Brendan. We're going to Troy from NMAX. If the release of last moment offers Mary's a sealed bid format, what is the advantage in making any changes to reach the same outcome?
Sorry, Carla, I think I missed the very beginning of that. Would you mind repeating that?
No. If the release of last moment offers mirrors a sealed bid format, what is the advantage in making any changes to reach the same outcome?
I think that the mirroring of the sealed bid format today results in many of the drawbacks of the sealed bid format, basically meaning the reduced opportunity for price discovery, without the corresponding benefits being the reduced potential for implicit coordination and price manipulation. And so I think if we're getting, you know, mostly the drawbacks of the approach without the fully realizing the benefits of the approach, it makes sense to move to the other option where we think that we can fully utilize or unlock the potential benefits.
Thanks, Brendan. We'll go to Santi from Capital Power. To provide the market with liquidity information for each product, is the ISO willing to consider posting the total volume of offers during or after each auction?
I think yes, we would certainly be willing to consider that. And so if participants would find that helpful, say if the disclosure was the offered volume and the clearing price of the auction in order to help participants assess, you know, the scarcity, clearing price, all that sort of stuff in order to inform whether they want to voluntarily participate in the OR market. I think that's exactly the sort of information that we're seeking, and we would consider that going forward.
Perfect. Thanks, Brendan. We've got one last written Q&A before we head over to the hands up. And this is from Tyler. I believe this is also, this is Suncor. I almost said TransAlta. Sorry, Tyler. Smaller aggregated megawatt providers are some of the most penalized participants in the OR market. Does the ISO have any reliability concerns around looking to enable smaller, approximately one megawatt volume players, especially if the ISO is looking to balance directives more evenly among all participants?
So Tyler, to answer your question, I think Brendan's kind of answered around the MSN directive, so I won't get into it. But regarding the smaller volume proposal that's currently in front of you, as you know, reliability is key, you know, be it smaller asset or bigger asset, reliability of the grid and participation is important to the ISO. So we have done studies, technical studies, that show that there is no impact reliability when we are looking to reduce the minimum size qualification requirements for operating reserves from the 15, 10, and 5 in this different for the different products to 1 megawatt. So the studies show that there are no reliability impacts to system performance during contingency events. And we will share those results in the next conversations that we'll have subsequent to the session. The other piece is that, like I said, technical requirements and meeting those technical requirements is key. So, and we have had a lot of conversations with yourself, Tyler, hosting a whole lot of people with issues that we've seen with higher assets, for example, higher megawatt assets. So at the end of the day, I think the key piece is that, you know, asset small or large is bound and obligated to meet our technical requirements. And if we feel that there are issues with meeting technical requirements, we'll engage in those conversations at the appropriate time, like we have engaged in the past almost a couple of years now with all of you in some form or other regarding technical requirements for the operating reserve market.
Thanks, Biju. All right, we're going to head over to Horst from Suncor. Horst, please go ahead and unmute.
Hello?
There you go.
Okay, this worked. Okay, thank you. I wanted to kind of comment also on the kind of any efforts to include more smaller participants into the market. I think this is kind of very misguided at a time where like the MSA report clearly shows kind of a bias on behalf of the ISO, whether conscious or unconscious or however. I mean, the chart is pretty damning in the report that kind of clearly shows that there's not even any overlap between the charts for the different size categories there that the MSA picked. So I personally think that unless we have seen that this has been reliably addressed by the ISO, i.e. that the next two or three market reports from the MSA show us that no, there is no longer an issue. Everybody is being treated equally in the market. I think it's actually, the chart itself almost suggests that you should do something else, and that is kind of maybe increase the minimum participation size to kind of at least increase the level playing field, because, basically doing this now seems really, really kind of misplaced timing-wise. Thank you.
So I can start on that. I think firstly, we've heard lots of feedback on directives both today and in the stakeholder matrix we received. And so we are looking at potential changes. Those changes at the earliest may be implemented in the end of Q2. And so you mentioned the next few MSA reports. Like the Q1 report would certainly not show any difference in any of our practices, as they have not changed since that time. I also just want to highlight that the directive rates for different providers are not currently part of the technical standards or requirements or descriptions of the products, and that when you are offering operating reserves and when you're providing operating reserves, you are making that capability available to the system controller. And when you receive a directive, you are compensated for the energy that you provide. I understand that there are perhaps reasons that some providers may wish to be directed more or less frequently based on what the energy pool price is. And so we're taking that into account. However, the idea that all assets receive the same number of directives, or that the directives are spread equally across all the assets, is not a fundamental part of the product. However, that being said, we do want to ensure that all the assets that are contracting to provide the service are able to provide the service, and that the system controller has full access to all the volumes that they require in the event of a contingency. And so we want to ensure that we can enable and monitor that capability going forward. And part of that will likely result in directive rates converging for different asset types. However, that's not part of the way that the product or the use of the product is defined.
Thanks for the information. I would say that I'm shocked, surprised, at the least, because I was under the assumption that everybody sells the same product. But if the ISO consciously dispatches or directs different parties differently based on its own attributes that are not public, then those are not the same product. And if we are talking about, oh, really, there's three different products for kind of each of these markets, then that's okay, but then you should expect three different prices for this. Particularly if it's not even public what kind of attributes you're using to distinguish providers. I mean, we can't have a single price be properly determined if parties are effectively selling different products. I mean, if people view directives as a risk, then it means that the risk to small providers is way lower. So if we open up the market to more small providers, you should see a flood of them coming in because, yeah, they have the simpler and less risky product. So I think, I'm really surprised that you come out and say that, oh, we never tell you how much we will direct you and you can't expect to be treated equally. I mean, that seems to go so far counter to FEOC, I'm not quite sure. So maybe you can explain that.
So I'll jump in here a little bit. So Horst, OR is a reliability product. And I think Brendan mentioned earlier that the product is directed by the system controller based on the system and reliability needs. And so I think that the system controller will always have that discretion, regardless of what changes we implement, as the fleet gets broader, as new technologies are integrated, as the size threshold changes. And so we went through a whole consultation last year, and I think that was mentioned before, on the distribution energy resources. And, you know, there was feedback there that, you know, reducing the size threshold is something that the ISO should look at. And, you know, other jurisdictions are doing the same thing based on technology changes and how the fleet is changing. And I think from the ISO's perspective, it reduces some barriers to entry. And so I won't go into some of the reasons why we actually were considering reducing the threshold, because I think we've gone through a whole stakeholder consultation on that as well. We hear your concerns. We are putting some measures in place so that as we reduce the threshold further, that all assets have the opportunity to provide the service that is contracted. And so we'll continue to progress that through this initiative.
Thanks, Rupa. All right, we're going to move on to Joseph. Joseph, you just have to unmute yourself. And if you can state your company name as well.
Can you hear me this time?
We can.
Awesome. This is Joseph Enolman from TransAlta. I think that we're kind of dancing around the point on the sealed bids. A price signal is only a price signal if you can actually do something to respond to that characteristic. And it just seems like you're removing the only price signal for that current market that we're trading. So it doesn't really benefit anyone if, due to today's price signal, I offer into tomorrow's market if my megawatts are needed for the current auction. I totally disagree with you saying that there is a price signal.
I think I certainly understand the point you're making that, you know, currently participants can observe the market, see how the market is developing, and they can try to make an assessment of whether their capability is needed. I agree that moving to a sealed bid format reduces the ability to do that. I think what we've come to realize in studying the OR market is that currently, just by looking at the development of the offer curve, it doesn't say too much about what the final volume in the market is going to be or what the final clearing price is going to be, because so many participants offer at the last moment. That being said, I'm sure that sophisticated participants are still able to use the information, even of those volumes that are offered into the market earlier than the last moment, to inform their assessment. And so I agree with you that it's one of the drawbacks of moving to a sealed bid format. However, we think that intraday price discovery, or as was mentioned earlier and as was clarified earlier, price discovery between subsequent auctions within the same procurement day can still occur with a sealed bid format. And so we're interested to hear the risks that you're talking about, and we do want to take those into account and make sure that we've weighed them and included them in our recommendation as we go forward into the next session.
It is an auction. Most of the competition is going to be back-ended to the end of the auction. That's just the nature of having an auction. I just don't know why you discount that competition in the last couple seconds of the market, because if you think that it's not based directly on the offers that are in the market, that's totally incorrect.
I don't think we've said it's not based on the offers in the market. As I said, I think sophisticated market participants are certainly able to see the markets, the offers that are in the market, and then take those into account with the flurry of activity at the end of the market. That's to be sure. As I mentioned, there are other open market formats that are specifically designed to maximize that flurry of competition and to make sure that participants make it to that flurry of competition with the most possible information available to them. Those formats that are well studied in the literature, they include, as I said, typically a dynamic format on the part of the auctioneer. And so if participants are interested in perhaps pursuing one of those options further, I think it's not, it's not eliminated yet. We could still look at, an open auction format with a dynamic clock mechanism. Our initial assessment of that is that those formats typically involve more complexity and more involvement on the part of the auctioneer, which in this case would likely be WADEX. However, if we do hear from participants that information is incredibly valuable into them submitting a competitive offer strategy and that the market can't function without it, then I think we're open to the idea of looking at some of the other well-studied and implemented auction formats based on the feedback that we received from this session and in the stakeholder matrix.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to go to Akira's last question before we continue on the presentation. Akira, please unmute.
Sure. Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. Just a couple of points I think Biju and Rupa had just raised. With respect to Eastern markets, I hear that the actual trend is actually moving away from actually participation distribution or distribution connected generation. And I think the same thing kind of applies here, in that this RTOs are concerned about their ability, RTO and ISO are concerned about their ability to monitor performance of these particular units. And in our case, distribution connected generation units are hooked up to a system that doesn't give a guarantee that they can get their megawatts back into the actual grid. And so I think that that's been overstated how much this is the actual trend that's being moved in or the general direction. I do think that they do have different thresholds there. But again, I think that we're subject to the same issue, that you don't have great visibility into DERS units. In fact, during some of the reliability events in your pandemic, we understood that the under-frequency load shed that was occurring actually triggered off some of these distribution-connected generation resources. So it just, I think that there is substantial concern about reliability of these particular units in terms of meeting operating reserves requirements. So I just want to put that out there because I don't want that to be left as unchecked.
Thanks, Akira. Thanks for your feedback. Very good points. So in Eastern markets, you're absolutely right. Even though FERC mandates or requires 100 kilowatt and above participation, BJM and MISO and all the folks, they do come across technical issues incorporating that low level of kilowatts rather. So yeah, the threshold is definitely 1 megawatt from where we have seen the rules are written in those Eastern markets and those ISOs. So, and that's the reason why we don't want to go into the discussions below 1 megawatt, specifically for that very same reason that you have pointed out, Akira. The second piece on DER stripping during under-frequency load shed events, yes, that has happened. We are working with DFOs in two spaces to address both the tripping issue as well as the monitoring and dispatchability issue. On the tripping issue, I can say that all the DFOs, if not already, are in the process of implementing the IEEE 1547 standard for tripping or riding through events that, and they should not trip and stay online. So that work has been going on with the DFOs for the past couple of years, and it's slowly getting implemented in the DFO space as we speak. And so that should help us with this nuanced tripping of DERs for future during future system events. So that's an ongoing work at the ISO, because we know that DERs are coming in full force, and we need to be prepared to it from a reliability perspective, from supply perspective, and a whole lot of other issues or challenges that that space has. The other piece around monitoring, I would like to add that we've also been working with DFOs in the monitoring and visibility space, because you are right, there is limited visibility on how much DERs are out there. And that's something that we have been working closely with the DFOs, trying to get SCADA signals for DERs in the various DFO regions that we have in Alberta. And that's on the general monitoring and visibility aspect. Specific to OR, like I said earlier, the requirements are stringent. There is a visibility aspect to DERs, but there's also a controllability aspect that we focus on, especially when it comes to operating reserves. And that is a stringent requirements, like I mentioned, be it this communication, be it SCADA. We need to ensure that's not just visibility aspect of it, but monitoring and dispatchability as well. So that is top of our mind, and the requirements are stringent in that aspect, whether you're a big asset or you're a small asset. So hopefully it helps answer some of your concerns, Akira.
Perfect. Thanks, Biju. Anything additional, Akira?
Sorry, no.
All right, thank you. All right, looks like we are moving on. Thank you to everyone for all your questions.
So I think we have a 10-minute break in the agenda now. I think we went a little, just slightly over on the Q&A, but I think we can still do 10 minutes. So I have 10:43, so that takes us to 10:53 to pick up again.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, I think we can move on. Thank you. We can just go straight to the next slide, I think. So welcome back, everyone. Following the Group 1 discussion, we're now going to go into the Group 2 design elements. And so we gave a very general introduction to some of these design areas in session 2. We didn't present any alternatives or anything like that. We just tried to make stakeholders aware that we were going to discuss these more in session 2. So here we are. The potential design elements that we want to discuss in this section are block procurement, contingency reserve procurement, which is a little vague, but I will clarify that, and also talk about standby reserves. We also, in session 1, we introduced OR curtailment priority for discussion in group 2, but we are not going to be moving forward with that potential change, but I can discuss the rationale there and more reasons for that once we get to it. So I think we can just jump right in to block procurement. So the current practice, the ISO, we procure reserves in 4 different time blocks. I won't read this out in its entirety, but effectively we have on and off peak blocks. And then there are also 2 super peak blocks, an AM block and a PM block. And we procure active regulating reserves in the AM and PM super peak blocks, as well as on and off peak. And for all the other reserve products, we procure just on and off peak. Some considerations that prompted us to want to take this to all of you for discussion. Our understanding is that there are technologies out there that may prefer the flexibility of having shorter procurement intervals, and in particular, if we were to move to an hourly procurement. But we also believe that there are other technology types that may prefer the commitment certainty that's associated with block procurement. And so we want to explore this to see if there's interest in perhaps changing the block procurement mechanism. We are at a very initial stage in this assessment. We're also aware that there may be cost efficiencies to capture based on the procurement shape of operating reserves if we were to move to a more granular time period, say hourly procurement. And so our priority in this initiative is to improve competition and price fidelity. However, if there is potential interest in this change from a competition and entry standpoint, then we would undertake this procurement shape analysis to see if the flexibility of hourly procurement may allow us to shape reserves and reduce excess reserves that may be procured due to block procurement. Next slide, please. So our proposed alternative that we want to take out is hourly reserve procurement. That being said, there are other potential options that we could look at if we hear feedback from stakeholders that a certain shape or duration of block would be ideal. But for now, we want to kind of assess the bookends of our current procurement design as well as hourly reserve procurement. We do want to stress that in a similar fashion to our view on standing offers, we don't believe that this change is required in order for us to maintain integrity in the market and to enable competition and price fidelity. And so we will only pursue this change further if we do hear that there is sufficient interest in from market participants in further analyzing this change. And we're very much seeking the feedback of a variety of participants on this. Some considerations relating to competition. We understand that there may be some asset types that would be able to provide reserves if we went to hourly procurement. Relating to effective operations, we understand there are other asset types for which block procurement may aid as a unit commitment decision factor. And relating to cost, we are aware that hourly procurement has the potential to have cost savings in order for us to have a more granular procurement shape. And so if stakeholders are interested in us conducting that analysis and looking at this further, then we can undertake to do that. And then the implementation costs, similarly, we expect there to be minimal implementation costs associated with this. However, we can explore that further once we have a design recommendation. The next group two design element is contingency reserve procurement. And so the current practice for both spinning and supplemental reserves, which are jointly referred to as contingency reserves, we procure them through separate sequential auctions today. And our current BAL002 WEC reliability standard requires that the ISO hold a minimum of at least 50% of our total contingency reserves as spinning reserves. And historically and currently, the ISO procures 50% of our contingency reserves as spinning reserves. Some considerations with this practice, volumes that are qualified for and are capable of providing spinning reserves would also be capable of providing supplemental reserves. And when the supplemental reserve price exceeds the spinning reserve price, we view that as a price inversion, as the ISO is buying supplemental reserves when spinning reserves that are substitutable for supplemental reserves may be available at a lower price than the supplemental reserves that we're procuring. We do understand how this happens and why this happens in the current sequential format, and we're aware that the sequential auction format is susceptible to these outcomes. However, we want to see whether there is a alternative procurement mechanism that may better reflect the fundamentals of these products. Just to give a sense of what we've observed in the market, here we show the instances of contingency reserve price inversions in the last 4 years. So the SUP price has exceeded the spinning reserve price in approximately 30 to 90 instances per year. However, it's very clear from this chart that the frequency of these price inversions occurring has been declining. So you can see, for example, when we gave the market power mitigation advice in 2019, there were nearly 80 instances per year where we were observing this price inversion. However, that's declined substantially to approximately 30 instances last year. We believe the primary driver of this is a new entry in the SUP market, which is creating more competition and driving the supplemental reserve clearing price below the spinning reserve price. So we do want to acknowledge that it appears that increased competition has helped to reduce the magnitude of this issue in recent years. So the proposed alternative that we want to explore and discuss today is to carry spinning reserve volumes that do not clear the spinning reserve procurement. And so that means volumes that are voluntarily offered into the spinning reserve market, but then do not clear the spinning reserve market. We want to carry those volumes forward into the supplemental reserve procurement. And so this would retain the current sequential approach for reserve procurement. The auction timing would remain the same as it is today. As I mentioned, spinning reserve offers that do not clear the market will be submitted into the supplemental reserve auction. Participants may improve their position in supplemental reserves. So that means that if they have spinning reserves that do not clear the market, and then those volumes are carried into the supplemental reserve market, they have the option to increase the volume of reserve that they're offering or lower the price of the reserves that they're offering. And to be clear, previous spinning reserve volumes that are then moved forward into the supplemental reserve procurement would be treated in all ways as being supplemental reserves. So they will become supplemental reserves as they go into that procurement. And then for the purposes of compliance, enforcement, technical standards, all that, they would be treated as supplemental reserves. The ISO also considered a different alternative, which would be to move to a simultaneous procurement approach for contingency reserves. Under this alternative, participants would simultaneously submit offers for both spinning reserves and supplemental reserves. All those contingency reserves would be aggregated into a single stack. And then we would be required to apply a clearing logic algorithm to that combined stack of contingency reserves in order to clear our contingency reserve needs at the lowest cost. That would result in a clearing mechanism that is marginally more complex than the mechanism that we have in today, in which the total reserve requirement, if we can meet that just using the lowest price reserves, the auction would end. Or if we were procuring reserves from lowest to highest cost, and at a point we found that we'd procured 50% of our reserves as supplemental reserves, that would mean that we couldn't procure any more supplemental reserves without being in violation of the 50% spinning BAL 002 WEC requirement. And so from that point on, the clearing logic would only accept spinning reserves beyond that point. So there is some complexity there, and I'm happy to discuss that or clarify if any stakeholders have questions about how that would work. However, this alternative is not the proposed alternative, but we are interested to hear feedback from stakeholders. On the next slide, I just have a brief example, an illustrative example of how the simultaneous or our proposed alternative would function. All the numbers here are just for illustrative purposes and are not necessarily reflective of any sort of actual data that we see in the market. The contingency reserve total volume need in this example is 300 megawatts. And that means that our spinning reserve need is 150 megawatts. And so in the spinning reserve procurement here, we see all the spinning reserve offers that have come into the market with the offered megawatt and the offered price. And we simply take the lowest priced spinning reserve offers. In this case, we need three offer blocks to meet the 150 megawatt reserve requirement. And this results in the 150 megawatts procured at a price of minus $30 per megawatt for spinning reserves. However, we then have four offer blocks that were submitted to the spinning reserve procurement that do not clear the market. And so they are brought forward into the supplemental procurement. And so on the next slide, we show what the supplemental reserve procurement would look like after the spinning reserve procurement. The volume need is 300 megawatts total. And since we have 150 megawatts of spin, that means we need 150 megawatts of supplemental in order to meet our requirement. And so we can see that the four residual spinning reserve offer blocks here have been denoted under the contingency reserve type as being spinning reserve turned into supplemental reserve. And they are integrated with new offers for supplemental reserve into the sub procurement. And so that gives us the seven offers that we see here with the associated megawatt and offer price. And so in order to get 150 megawatts of supplemental reserve procured, we need to take the four lowest price offer blocks. And this results in 150 megawatts of supplemental reserve being procured at a price of $0 per megawatt. And if we had not taken the residual spinning reserve offers into this market, then the supplemental price would have been $30 per megawatt. And so we want to acknowledge that in this instance, spinning reserve was priced at negative 30 and supplemental reserve ends up at a price of zero. So this does not resolve completely instances of price inversions. However, it does serve to minimize the problem further and better reflects the interchangeability or the substitutability of spinning reserve into supplemental reserve. So here we have an evaluation of some of the common considerations for both options, as well as some of the considerations that apply to one option or the other. So relating to competition, we believe that both of these alternatives would create a broader base of liquidity with which we can procure contingency reserves. However, we think it's very important to acknowledge that spinning reserve participants are sophisticated, and we would expect that they would adjust their offer behavior into the spinning reserve procurement to account for this new auction mechanism, and that that may limit the extent to which this may result in realized benefits. Relating to effective operations and pricing, we believe that pricing supplemental reserve at a premium to spinning reserve sends price signals that conflict with the fundamentals of the products. And we also acknowledge that increased competition has recently reduced the instances of price inversions that we've observed. Another consideration for option two specifically relating to effective operations and pricing is that if we were to use a simultaneous procurement mechanism, we believe this would substantially complicate the position control of the procurement, meaning it would become much more challenging to ensure that capacity is not being contracted for multiple services using the same tranche of capacity. And so that may complicate the checks and balances that are in the procurement to prevent that from happening. And that was one contributing factor to our recommendation of option one as being our proposed alternative. Relating to cost, again, implementation cost is something that we can look at in more detail once the design recommendations have been determined. For our sequential option one, the proposed alternative, we've estimated the potential savings using historical offers for the last few years. And we found approximately $1 million per year of cost savings. However, I mentioned at the very beginning that for many of these changes that we are pursuing. Quantifying benefits can be very challenging and in some cases, perhaps a little spurious. And so in this instance, while we've estimated $1 million per year, we do acknowledge that updated offer behavior from participants in response to this change may impact the realized savings that we'd actually see in the market. Relating to the simultaneous approach, we believe that the implementation cost may be moderately higher than for the sequential approach, in that the clearing logic itself would become more complex, as well as the position control checks and balances that I mentioned earlier. And we believe the cost savings should be similar to the sequential approach as they achieve a similar outcome. Relating to public interest, we believe the sequential approach does add some minor complexity to the market, which we want to be careful of, as simplification and streamlining and enhancing participation is an objective of this initiative. So we don't want to add complexity to the market without sufficient justification. And again, that was a contributing factor to us preferring the sequential approach over the simultaneous, is that we think the simultaneous approach adds more complexity to the market than the sequential approach without necessarily tangibly better outcomes as a result. On slide 55, we can now move to OR curtailment priority. So as I mentioned, the curtailment priority of operating reserves was included in our first session as an item that we would discuss in session two. Since that time, we've continued the assessment of potential alternatives for this. This included the current curtailment practices for operating reserves and energy under ISO Rule 203.6, which is the available transfer capability and transfer path management rule for the interties, as well as for ISO Rule 302.1, which is the real-time transmission constraint management rules. So in light of our updated thinking, the ISO has determined that we won't be pursuing changes to these practices at this time. It doesn't mean that there aren't potentially benefits to be captured here, but a broader review of the potential alternatives found that the impacts of changes to these rules would go beyond the scope that we're targeting in this initiative of enhanced competition and price fidelity in the OR markets. And additionally, we estimated that the implementation timeframe for potential changes would likely exceed the 2022 to 2023 target that we've established for this initiative. The final design element in Group 2 that we want to discuss is standby reserves. Firstly, both internally and based on stakeholder feedback, the starting point with which we wanted to approach this was assessing the value and the need for standby reserves as a whole before we went into specific detail about the way that standby reserves are priced and procured. And so we determined that standby reserves serve several purposes in the market today. Each of these are implicitly compared to a situation in which we don't procure standby reserves, or in which we procure extra active reserves instead of standby reserves. So firstly, standby reserves enhance reliability as they're able to fill in when an active OR provider is unable to provide the product. Standby reserves also reduce our total overall procurement costs due to the probabilistic nature of day-ahead reserve requirement forecasting. And so if we were to only procure active reserves to meet our reserve needs, if we wanted to have the same degree of certainty as we do today, we would have to procure more active reserves, which would result in a persistent over-procurement of reserves. Alternatively, if we were not to procure those extra active reserves, it would result in higher rates of out-of-market conscription for reserves in order to meet our reliability requirements. The next consideration for standby reserves is that they maximize competition in the energy market, because standby volumes are able to continue participating in the energy market to the extent that that's applicable for resources that do participate in the energy market. And finally, standby reserves facilitate an openly competitive market as they act as an additional layer of market-priced services before we resort to out-of-market conscriptions. And so in evaluating these different aspects, the ISO does not believe that these outcomes can be achieved using only active reserves. And therefore, we recommend to continue procuring standby reserves. However, with adjustments to the pricing and procurement mechanism for these reserves. So just a quick overview of the current practice for standby reserves. I did cover some of this in session one, but I can review it again here. So as I mentioned, standby reserves are procured in order to meet our reserve requirements when the active portfolio is insufficient. And market participants submit a two-part offer to the WADEX platform that includes both a premium and an activation price. Those prices are then combined using what is the blended price formula to determine which offers will clear the market. And so the blended price takes the premium price and adds to it the activation price that is weighted by an activation percentage. This activation percentage is determined by the ISO, and participants that clear the market are then paid the premium for each hour in which they're dispatched to provide standby reserves. And if they're activated to start providing operating reserves, they're also paid the activation price. And both of these payments are made on a pay-as-bid basis. Some considerations for the current mechanism. Firstly, we believe that the lack of an index to the energy pool price for the activation price creates uncertainty for participants and also introduces unnecessary price risk. We also believe that the current procurement mechanism is just complex in nature and perhaps more complex than it needs to be. And we also believe that the pay-as-bid pricing structure distorts offer strategy incentives when compared with a uniform pricing structure. So we have two proposed alternatives that we want to discuss with stakeholders. We haven't ruled out either of these alternatives yet, as we want to get stakeholder feedback and better understand some of the fundamentals that might lead us to prefer one of these alternatives over another. So the first alternative that I want to share is to move to single part offer structure, where participants submit only an activation price. This activation price would be indexed to the energy pool price. And so in that way, it would be very similar to the way that active reserves are priced. And we believe that this mitigates the pool price risk that necessitates the current premium payment. The market would then be cleared using a uniform pricing mechanism instead of a pay-as-bid format. The uniform price for these products could be set in one of two ways that we've identified. The simplest and the way that would require the least changes based on today's pricing mechanism would be to price day ahead the way we do today. However, another alternative would be to set standby reserve activation prices in real time. And so the day ahead option would have us go into the day ahead market, clearing a set volume, and then the uniform activation price would be set at the highest cleared offer. This would be very analogous to the way that the active reserve market functions today. Or all participants that submit offers day ahead would then be carried to the real time market. Apologies about my dog. All day ahead offers. I'm sorry, I might need to resolve that so that we can focus. I'll be back shortly.
I'm just picking up on where Brendan left off before he comes back. So under the first alternative, all day ahead offers could be carried into the real time, and the activation price would vary in the real time based on the highest activated offer. And then the second alternative is to move to single part offers with only a premium price. Brendan's back. Go ahead, Brendan.
Thanks, I promise that if our next session is in person, I won't bring my dog to that. So, so moving, I think you covered the second option there, Rupa, but I might just elaborate on it a bit because it's a little more complex. The second option is that we carry all day head offers to real time, and then we effectively establish a merit order of standby reserve providers for which the activation price would be set in real time and would vary based on the highest activated offer at any given time. And so in that sense, it would be similar to the way that the energy market is currently priced. And there may be some complications related to settlement and that sort of thing that we want to discuss with stakeholders and take into account. The second broad alternative that we want to discuss is to again move to single part offers, but instead participants would submit only a premium price to WattX. So in this case, they would be paid, or we would pay active activated standby reserve providers whatever the prevailing active reserve price is at that time. And so that aligns active and standby in that all providers of a particular product at a given time, whether you are an active provider or an activated standby provider, would be earning the same price. And if market participants require a higher price than the active reserve price, which we do understand that participants have different cost fundamentals and that a standby provider might require a higher price than what the prevailing active reserve price is, we believe that they can account for that in their offer strategy for the premium price. As in our current sequential format, active reserves are procured before standby reserves. And even with changes to transparency that we're contemplating, we would still want to ensure that standby reserve providers would know what the cleared active reserve price is before offering into standby. And so if the standby reserve provider requires a price that's a certain amount above what the prevailing active reserve price is, they can account for that in their premium. As an activated standby provider earns both the activation price and the premium simultaneously. Then we would clear the market, again, using a uniform pricing mechanism. And so whichever the highest cleared premium price is would set the price for all providers in the market. So on the next slide, we've compared and contrasted some of the considerations for these alternatives. Relating to competition, for both options, we think that by simplifying pricing, it may encourage more participation and more robust competition. Relating to the activation price alternative, under that option, because we're choosing to mitigate the pool price risk through an index, the premium payments would not be paid anymore. And so we want to acknowledge that the removal of that revenue stream, the removal of premium payments, may reduce the incentive for participation. Related to effective operations and pricing, some common considerations, the indexed activation price in either instance, whether it's submitted by the standby provider or whether it's the prevailing active reserve price, will mitigate the pool price risk that's experienced for reserve providers. And a uniform price format will create better offer strategy incentives. Relating to the activation price alternative, if we were to move to real-time activation prices, that would mean that we could carry all day-ahead volumes into real-time. And thereby, if we do find ourselves needing more reserves in real time, those competitively priced market procured reserves are there in that stack and can be activated, increasing the activation price and reducing out of market conscriptions. In the premium price option, we are seeking participant feedback to understand the cost fundamentals associated with the premium price, and in particular, whether there are direct costs or opportunity costs that are associated with a provider of inactivated standby reserves. So in other words, a provider of standby reserves that is still able to freely participate in the energy market. And what this will allow us to do is assess really whether there's a cost fundamental basis for the premium payment, or whether the premium payment really is just there as a compensation for pool price risk. Relating to cost, again, implementation cost can be explored further once we've gotten further with our design recommendations. We do believe that many of the changes here are minimal. However, if we were to move to real-time reserve pricing, there may be more involvement associated with the systems for pricing and settlement of real-time priced standby reserves. Relating to the activation price alternative, because the premium payment stream has gone away, that may reduce procurement costs by some amount. And also, when we're moving to real-time activation prices, I mentioned that there are considerations for pricing and settlement that may result in a higher implementation cost relative to the other options. And finally, relating to public interest, we believe that both options, because they move to a single price uniform auction, but that results in a format that is more transparent and is also less complex. So we've covered a lot of information in the session today, and so just want to briefly recap before we go into our last discussion period. So firstly, in group one, where we were assessing the equilibrium pricing and ISO bid price, our draft recommendation is to remove equilibrium pricing, set the market price at the marginal offer, and then to explore the considerations and options for the price cap or price caps for each product in session three. For standing offers, our draft recommendation is to not pursue at this time, as the reliability risk that was highlighted by some participants may outweigh the benefit at this time. Relating to offer transparency, our draft recommendation is to move to a sealed bid format. Ex post offer disclosure information, it's clear from participant feedback that it's very important. And so we want to better understand and collect more feedback on the way that we disclose offer information. And we want to discuss that in session three. In particular, some things came up today about how knowing the price immediately after a procurement has ended, going into the subsequent procurement is important. And also that perhaps a measure of the total volume that was offered into a market can help market participants make an assessment of the liquidity and or the scarcity of a product in conjunction with the clearing price. Relating to the minimum qualification and offer size, our draft recommendation is to move to a minimum size of 1 megawatt for all reserve types and to streamline dispatch tolerance to 5% for all assets. In group two, as we just discussed, relating to block procurement, we wish to explore the option of hourly procurement with stakeholders, and we are also open to other specific alternatives if stakeholders have an option that they'd like us to consider. Relating to contingency reserve procurement, the alternative we'd like to explore is carrying residual spinning reserve offers forward into the procurement for supplemental reserves. And finally, relating to the pricing and procurement of standby reserves, we have the two alternatives. Firstly, where we move to a single part uniform priced format where participants submit only an activation price. And secondly, if we determine there's sufficient fundamental reason and justification for the premium payment, then we can explore the option of moving to a single part uniform format using only a premium price. And so with that, that takes us to the second discussion period for the day. And so we're happy to take any comments or questions and to discuss with the group.
Perfect. I'll go with Santi had some questions early on, and then we'll move on to our hands up. So Santi from Capital Power at 1058, how does the ISO envision the auctions for hourly products work?
So I think that's an excellent question. To be honest, that was one of our initial considerations that made us think that that standing offers may be helpful for participants. If we are moving to more procurements, potentially for more time blocks and the sequence that those would occur in, I think that is all up for discussion and up for stakeholder feedback at this point. And I don't know that we have a particular set path forward for the timing of that.
Thanks, Brendan. Another one from Santi. In the carry forward option for CR procurement, please confirm that market participants would have the ability to remove their uncleared SR offers from the SUP auction.
So in the option we've proposed, they would not have that capability. So participants that have offered to submit spinning reserves for a particular price, the ISO will implicitly or I suppose explicitly consider that they would also be willing to provide supplemental reserves for that price. And so once those volumes are taken into the supplemental procurement, the participant would have the option of improving their position in that they may either lower the price of their offer or they may raise the volume of their offer. If participants have concerns about that, I think we're open to understand what some of the risks associated with that might be.
Brendan, I see that as you were providing your response, Santi just put his hand up. So maybe we'll allow him to talk because he may have a clarifying question here. So Santi, sure. If you just want to unmute.
Hey, Brendan, can you hear me?
Yes, thanks.
It's good to see you. I think you answered the follow-up part to my question in terms of, you know, then if you say we can improve our position, what exactly does that mean? And you had kind of mentioned we can either lower our price or change our volume.
I could increase the volume.
Increase the volume.
Yeah.
That was the follow-up question that I had. So, okay. No, that's fine.
Thanks, Santi.
Yep, well, thanks.
Perfect. Thanks. All right. We have two more questions from Santi. Just there was a confirmation on the title of the slide of 52 and 53. It says simultaneous CR procurement option, and he wanted to confirm if this was a typo, whether it should be sequential, not simultaneous.
That may have been a typo. I don't know if we can just go to the slide really quick, to slide 52, just to confirm, but I suspect I think that was a typo. So thanks for pointing that out. These two slides should say sequential CR procurement, option one.
Perfect.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. And then the last one from Santi, before the feedback submission deadline, can the ISO please provide examples for each of the standby reservice pricing alternatives and how the ISO envisions them working? Please include the timing of activation, price paid, et cetera.
I think we can provide some more information on that. The last part, the timing of price paid, I don't know if we could get clarification on what you're looking for in respect to that. Was that also from Santi?
Yes, it was. Oh, there we go. Santi, if you just want to unmute yourself, there you go.
Yeah, I think what I just want to understand is just be very clear as to how these options would work, both in terms of activation, dispatch, pricing, and payment. What are we getting paid or not, based on what? When are we being dispatched or directed? I think it wasn't clear to me in reading the slides. So having a concrete example of each would certainly help to better understand what it is these options are.
Sure. I think what we may be able to do is include that as a preface of some sort in the stakeholder matrix so that participants will be able to all see that information and then provide their comments. I can take that away though, and we can confirm that, but I think that might be an option for that.
Yeah, I think it would be necessary for at least us, because I mean, whether we provide comments on these options, I think certainly the merit of any comments will certainly depend on the understanding and clarity of what it is that the ISO is recommending. So without that clarity, we may be just two ships passing in the night.
Of course, yeah. We'll make sure we can make it clear what our proposed alternative is.
Great. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Santi. Thank you, Brendan. All right. So we're going to go to Will. Will Chow, you'll just have to unmute yourself. And if you can just state your organization. Thank you.
Thanks, Carla. Hey, Brendan, can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
First off, good to see you, and well done on having the endurance to go 3 hours here. This is Will Chow with Power Advisory. I just have a main question comment about the block procurement. I'm just wondering if the ISO's done any work that they're willing to share about the current and potential future benefits and challenges of going to block procurement on their side, right? As I mean, it makes sense that block procurement worked well in a time when daily demand was the main driver of CR needs, but going forward, where that a lot of that might hinge on wind or intertie, is there any work that you've done about the delta, the kind of like the volume savings you achieve by going to block procurement, what that looks like going forward?
Right. I think we understand that there are some of those potentials and that some of that analysis could help assess the merit of changing the procurement blocks. I think that analysis is still yet to be done. And the approach in this initiative, we understand that there may be other rationales for perhaps adjusting block procurement, and that there are, you know, going forward, there may be other considerations. But from this, in this initiative, we're really approaching it from the stance of, for block procurement, especially primarily from competition and entry. And so we want to understand whether there is merit in pursuing a change on that basis. And if there is, then I think obviously in order to ensure coordination and alignment with other objectives and initiatives, we'll want to make sure we've considered it from all angles at that point. But I think that our first question for stakeholders is to understand the justification from a competitive standpoint. And then we can undertake some of that further analysis if needed at that point. Otherwise, I think it would more likely fit in with some of the longer term market changes that we've alluded to in this initiative where, you know, over a much longer time frame, several years, we do a more holistic, fulsome evaluation of the suite of OR products and the role they serve in the changing grid and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, thanks. Just one more quick comment on the sequential contingency reserve procurement, like moving this the unbought spin into SUP. It might be one of those things that you need to resolve before you get full and comprehensive view and comment on the bid mechanics / offer transparency that's in group one, like the whether or not spin volumes flow down into SUP might really impact market participants' view on the offer transparency side of things.
Okay, thank you for that comment. And I think we can perhaps ensure that our stakeholder matrix accounts for that specifically. And we can maybe look at having a question that points specifically to the interaction between those and how it may influence the feedback that we receive.
Great. Thanks, Brendan.
Thanks, Will. Thanks, Brendan. All right, we're just going to, Ethan, you've got a question in the written Q&A, and we're just wondering if you wouldn't mind putting your hand up, just if you could provide a little bit of clarification on exactly what you were meant by your question would be appreciative. Oh, there you go. Thanks. Thanks, Ethan. If you just want to unmute yourself, please go ahead.
Yeah, let me know if I'm coming through.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, I was, and I think this is alluding to the aggregate assets. Is that correct?
And Ethan, maybe I'll just read the question. And so I believe there was a miscommunication with my previous question on aggregated assets. Could you please confirm if existing assets under 5 megawatts participate currently under the aggregate asset options available? And Ethan's from TransAlta. Thanks.
Yeah, maybe just to elaborate, like we see supplemental load participants who are an aggregate of smaller individual loads. And I'm curious if those individual load sites and ultimately larger, if it was generation sites, the same thing, if there's existing assets or sites that are less than the 5 megawatt or 10 megawatt requirements for the markets.
I think, Ethan, just to make sure I understand the question correctly, and maybe I'll try responding and see if that helps. So as far as the ISO is concerned, it's the minimum size requirements that we look at. You could have a portfolio of assets at lower volumes, but at the end of the day, it's about what gets dispatched as a single asset, independent of the composition of the asset behind the scenes, and as well as how the asset performs at the aggregate level through a network operation center, for example, which a lot of these supplemental loads have. So it's that performance of the portfolio as a whole from a meeting technical requirements, including the size qualification that we look at. I hope that helps answer the question, Ethan.
Okay. Am I summarizing correctly that it would be possible for smaller assets less than 5 megawatts to act as aggregate and participate in the existing infrastructure then?
The aggregate has to meet the minimum size requirements, independent of the sizing of assets that make up the composition of the aggregate.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful and answers my question.
And just to add on to what Biju said, they would also need to meet the technical requirements for performance, the aggregated asset.
Yeah, thank you again.
Thanks, Ethan, Rupa, and Biju. We have one more one question here from James from TransAlta. James, if you just want to unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hi, thanks for that. Yeah, I just wanted to maybe get a little more color on the potential $1 million savings with the changes to or the exploratory changes to the sequential spin of SOP. I'm just surprised, given the supplemental market, how it clears over the past couple of years. Like, for example, this year it's cleared roughly at like a minus 110 discount for off-peak relative to an off-peak price of 60. There's a similar relationship in the on-peak, and that relationship has held now for over past couple of years. And yet you see a problem with that market, like clearing at potential premiums or not clearing, or was it at a level where there's like excess profits, I guess is kind of was my takeaway.
I don't know that we've made any assertion about excess profits or anything like that, but I think the pricing of the products relative to each other. So the way that that analysis was conducted basically took exactly what we've described in option one of the sequential. Did I say that right? Sequential? Yes. The sequential approach for the contingency reserve procurement. So if there were offers we received for spinning reserve that did not clear the market, we took those offers and combined them with the supplemental reserve offers that we had, while ensuring that we weren't double counting or exceeding the qualification or qualified volumes, rather, of any particular asset. And then we cleared the market in a counterfactual manner to see where the new clearing would be. And you're right that there was a trend, whereas in recent years, it's become less of a problem for sure. Interestingly, the trend of that savings, it was downward as well, but it was less pronounced than the trend of the price inversions. So I mentioned $1 million a year. I think in those earlier years where we saw the the higher levels of price inversions, it was closer to perhaps say about $1.5 million, something like that. And then in more recent years, we saw it fall down to about that million level that I shared in the presentation today. So it did decline during that time period, but it didn't go away. And the number we've shared is reflective of the fewer instances that we've seen more recently. I'll also note that that analysis only went to the end of 2021. And so there's no 2022 data in any of that. And sorry, I just said it went to the end of 2021. It didn't actually go all the way to the end of 2021. It was, it used a partial year of 2021 data, and it then calculated that in an annualized manner.
Thanks for that, Brendan. So is it, the ISO is, given the recent trend, is it fair to say that you're still concerned with that relationship going forward or the trend?
I think it's fair to say that based on the analysis we've done, it looks like there's still potential for improvements. But I think it's unquestionable that the magnitude of the problem we've observed has gotten smaller in recent years. And so whether there's still sufficient justification to warrant the change, I think we're open to stakeholder feedback on that. We do see, you know, there are tangible benefits that we've qualified in a couple ways in the presentation today. And so I think that there is potentially still value in moving forward with that, but we're interested on to hear what stakeholders make of the recent data that we've observed, and especially, you know, what we think the state of the market might be going forward, what the potential weighing of the trade-offs will be for that.
Thanks for the follow-up.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks, James and Brendan. All right. We don't have any more hands up or any questions in the Q&A. Do we want to move to the next steps?
So just moving on to the next steps, I first want to thank everyone for taking the time to attend this session. Your feedback and participation is appreciated. We know there's a lot on the go right now. As noted throughout the session today, at the highest level, the market is functioning, but there are several design elements that are not performing in a way that promotes efficiency. The options and draft recommendations that were presented today are expected to promote efficient outcomes and increase competition in the OR market. Further, there are near and long-term initiatives that may drive change in the OR market, and the changes presented today will set us up for a more efficient market for these potential future changes. So as we go on to the path forward, I think Nicole mentioned earlier, we are planning to do another session in late August. And the purpose of that session is to explore and discuss operating reserve price caps and any detailed recommendations on all the design elements. We will take some of the feedback that was given throughout the session today and in the comment matrix, and we will definitely take that into consideration as we work through the recommendations and the outstanding options. And then we go into the, we would, depending on how that process goes, we would go into the rule, the ISO rule process, which is outlined here. Carly, next slide. So yeah, thank you. We look forward to your input and your feedback. The comment matrix should be posted in the next couple of days. And we look forward to your participation throughout this initiative.
And just before we close, Rupert, it looks like we have one question, a hand up.
Yeah.
Megan, if you just want to unmute yourself and state what organization you're with. Thank you.
Hello, Megan Gill with Capital Power. Kind of on the wrap-up slides or kind of going back to some of the questions that came up from Horst and Akira earlier in the session around kind of the process and the feedback between sessions and things like that. I have a question about the, I guess after the last session, we had some concerns about the analysis that's the proposed recommendations are being based on, and the fact is a lot of it's kind of based on historical observations, and wanting a bit more clarity on, you know, what these recommended changes, what the impact will be more on a go forward basis. So I'm not sure if that's something that the ISO can respond to now, or if there's some more information that can be provided so that, you know, there's no point in raising the same concerns in the next comment matrix. But I do think it would be helpful to understand more of that, you know, the cost benefit, what these recommendations are, what the impact will actually be on a more go forward basis, especially with, you know, expected changes in market concentration, for example.
I think I can comment on that, and then if someone else wants to jump in, go ahead. To begin with, I'd just turn back to the slide I shared near the beginning, I think, relating to quantifying potential benefits related to some of these changes. I think, you know, the nature of the initiative we're in is that we want to enable competition, and ultimately forecasting the amount of entry you might receive in the OR markets, I think, is very speculative for anyone to do, including the ISO. And so the amount of benefit that we are able to capture as a result of increased entry, I think, is simply very challenging to estimate. And while there may be some kind of assumptions we may be able to make, I think those assumptions would tend to be somewhat arbitrary and speculative. However, if you have a suggested analysis that you'd like to see in particular, I certainly invite you to provide us with the details of that in the comment matrix about what you think might be a reasonable way in order to forecast entry into a market going forward or something like that. The data set we might use, the assumptions or methods we might apply, I think we'd be more than happy to undertake an analysis that was described in that way. Otherwise, I think we certainly are interested in quantifying benefits and providing quantitative analysis in order to support our recommendations where we can. And we'll continue to do so. And I believe that there will be some quantitative analysis on some of the different options here that we can explore in session 3.
Okay, and just thank you for that, Brendan. Just to be clear, so as part of session 3, you said there's going to be like a detailed kind of information provided on each of these group 1 and group 2 alternatives that would include the analysis?
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, we now have a couple other hands up. We've got, Akira, if you want to unmute yourself, please go ahead. Oh, Akira, something might have happened there. Just please raise your hand again and we'll get you unmuted. My apologies. Please go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So we've been waiting for the net demand variability report. Do you know when that's coming out? Because like I said, I mean, I think that report was to give us portend a little bit about what reliability needs might be in the future and what we might think about resource or operating reserve products. I had thought that it was expected to come out at the end of Q1. Is that on one timeline, and how does that work with the timeline of this initiative?
Yeah, Kira, this is B2. So Q2, it's by Q2 is when the flexibility report, the NDV report, is going to come out.
Okay. I strongly recommend, as we have all along the way, that a lot of this initiative could be replowing that ground if that report does recommend changes to the OR market. And I know the ISO's position that apparently you think that you're not wasting our time by asking us to opine about initiatives on tweaks to a market when it could possibly be redesigned, or maybe not. But I would ask you to consider that in terms of the burden that you place on stakeholders, because as much as you believe that these are not going to force us to reconsider the same issues, in fact, the operating reserves market and a lot of the things that you've talked about today are replays of many other discussions. I don't understand the urgency of what you set out in the schedule, and I would like to see a little bit of better coordination between the other issues that got worked out. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thanks, Aguirre. Thanks for input. And I think that's the whole purpose of why we're deliberate in the way that we've crafted the scope. And you'll see in the flexibility report as and when it comes out that, ISO has considered this input, but happy to engage more with you and anyone else who might share similar concerns, once the report is released as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Aguirre. Thanks, Bijou. All right, no more questions or hands up. So I think we can end the session. All right, thank you everyone for attending, and appreciate your feedback, and look to when the comment matrix will be posted in the next few days. Thanks so much.